Well, it's great to be here with you at the Crescent this evening, and thank you very much, David, for your very, very kind welcome and introduction. My topic tonight is God good? And in particular, I've been asked to look at this in the context of the Old Testament. We talked earlier in the discussion that we had about the new atheism, and one of the things that has happened in that context is that the goodness of God has been challenged by looking at the claims of the Old Testament. And so my job tonight, in the next half an hour or so, is to try to give a little bit of an introduction to this topic. It's an enormous topic, and I won't possibly be able to do justice to it, but I do want to get you started thinking about it. What I would like to do, just to set the context for where we're going, let me just see if the technology is working. Oh, there we go, sorry. I'm looking at the wrong screen here. So I want to first of all look at the new atheism and the Old Testament, of what they have to say about it, and then I want to think about what we mean about the goodness of God. So before we get into how exactly we're going to handle the question that they're asking, what do we mean by the goodness of God, then I want to look at what the new atheists ignore, before going on to three specific challenges: immoral characters and the harsh laws of the Old Testament, slavery in the Old Testament, and last but not least, the conquest of Canaan. Now, I'm not, as I said, going to be able to do justice to all those topics. On the first two in particular, my coverage will be very brief. I'll maybe try to spend a little bit longer on the last one. So first of all, the new atheists, what do they have to say about this? Richard Dawkins, in his book The God Delusion, says that the ethnic cleansing begun in the time of Moses is brought to bloody fruition in the book of Joshua, a text remarkable for the bloodthirsty massacres it records and the xenophobic relish with which it does so. The late Christopher Hitchens, another leading figure of the new atheism, wrote that the Bible may, indeed does, contain a warrant for trafficking in humans, for ethnic cleansing, for slavery, for bride price, and for indiscriminate massacre. And Sam Harris, an American author, says that if we take the Bible seriously, then we must stone people to death for imaginary crimes. And he lists what these imaginary crimes, according to the Old Testament, are. They include things like heresy and breaking the Sabbath. Okay? So these are some of the things that the new atheists have to say. Now, I'll talk a little bit more about the new atheists in just a moment, but let me first of all say that there is a challenge here. If you're a Christian, you know there's a challenge. You've read your Bible. You've read the New Testament, but I hope you've also read the Old Testament. And there are things that are difficult to understand. And so one of the things that we as Christians need to do, and so we should be grateful to the new atheists for helping us to do it, because they're forcing us to think about some of these difficult questions. And sometimes we'd rather ignore them. And I think that's a mistake. To start off with, then, I want to think about the goodness of God. Let's just get this in context. Because as Christians, we believe that God is perfectly good in everything he does. This is what the Bible teaches. And this is just what we mean by God. We couldn't have a God. It doesn't make sense to talk about a God who is evil, for example. The whole idea of God is that not only that he is great, that he is powerful and all-knowing, but that he is completely good. And we can spell that out in terms of various attributes that God has, and we could go through the scriptures to look at these in more detail, to talk about God's love, his moral perfection, his justice, his faithfulness, his mercy, and so on. That would be a great talk to give, but it's not my talk for this evening. But furthermore, God is the source of everything good, and God is the standard of goodness. If you say that a person is good, what I think you mean by this is that there is some standard against which you're evaluating that person. You're saying that they conform to the standard of goodness. And the question is, where do you get that standard from? Is it just one that you've made up yourself? Is it one that you've just got from your parents or that your society has made up? Or is there really an objective standard of good? We talked about science earlier and mathematics. In mathematics, 2 plus 2 equals 4. I didn't make this up. This is just the way it is. When we say that someone or something is good, is it like saying 2 plus 2 equals 4? Is it an objective fact? Or is it just a personal opinion? Well, when we think about things that are truly evil, when we think about murder, for example, then this is not just an opinion, this is a fact. It's an objective fact that murder is wrong. When we say that God is good, where does this standard come from? Is there some standard outside of God that we evaluate God against? Now, Christians will normally say that there is no such standard outside of God. The standard is God's character itself. God is the very standard of goodness. Not only is he good, but goodness, if you like, is defined by who God is. There is no other standard. So this raises a question. Where do the new atheists get their standard of goodness from? And in fact, that's not so clear. Because they believe that the universe, the physical universe, is all there is, that we have come about as a result of an unguided process. There is no purpose. We are the result of the collision of atoms and molecules. Ultimately, that is all there is. And in such a universe, the question arises, how could anything be good or evil? Richard Dawkins helps us. He has written that in a universe of blind physical forces and genetic replication, some people are going to get hurt. Other people are going to get lucky, and you won't find any rhyme or any reason in it, nor any justice. The universe that we observe has precisely the properties we should expect if there is, at bottom, no design, no purpose, no evil, no good, nothing but pitiless indifference. That is the world of the new atheism. And that puts a slightly different perspective on it. How then, from this position that Dawkins states, can I get on this moral high horse and start castigating the God of the Old Testament? Where does he get his morality from? And I don't think that Richard Dawkins or any of the other atheists have given a satisfactory, of the new atheists, have given a satisfactory answer to that question. Nevertheless, there is still a legitimate question that we as Christians need to think about. And what I want to do is just to think very briefly about how we might approach the problem. And it relates to the discussion we had earlier in the interview. The way I approach this is, first of all, by thinking, well, what's at stake in this discussion? Let's suppose I can't give an adequate answer to the new atheists about the Old Testament. Well, let me actually think in terms of what's not at stake. What's not at stake is the existence of God. As I mentioned earlier, there are plenty of good reasons for belief in God, many of these coming from modern science. It's also not the claims of the Gospels or the resurrection of Jesus, the central claims of Christianity. Again, I think there are very good reasons for believing that Christianity is true. We don't have time to go into these. The new atheists, will claim otherwise. But when you look at the writings on this, many people, including many atheists, think that when it comes to attacking Christian belief, they do a really bad job. They're more interested in ridiculing belief than they are at evaluating it in a rational, objective way. So that's not what's at stake. There are legitimate questions, but it's not Christianity and it's not the existence of God that is at stake in this discussion. Furthermore, we want to understand the problem. We don't want to minimize it, pretend that there's no issue. But we also want to understand what the Bible says. And I really want to emphasize that as we think about these things, we need to take seriously what the Bible actually says, not what we think the Bible might say. And furthermore, we need to recognize our own limitations. In the context of science, this is something I am all too aware of. When you're doing science, there's all sorts of issues that arise, and you don't know how to make sense of it. Just as a scientist, not talking about belief in God here. Things that seem to be true but don't fit together. Now, what do scientists do? Do they just reject everything? Of course not. They're willing to live with the tension in the hope that further information will shed further light and resolve the conflict. And so, just because I can't resolve some of these questions tonight does not mean there is no resolution. So let's just be careful as we approach the subject tonight. Well, with that by way of introduction, let me then look at what the new atheists ignore. So if we turn to Deuteronomy 10, and Deuteronomy is one of the books of the Bible that the new atheists will point to, we read in chapter 10, verse 17, "For the Lord your God is God of gods and Lord of lords, the great God, mighty and awesome, who shows no partiality and accepts no bribes. He defends the cause of the fatherless and the widow and loves the foreigner residing among you, giving them food and clothing. And you are to love those who are foreigners, for you yourselves were foreigners in Egypt." Leviticus chapter 19. "Do not pervert justice. Do not show partiality to good or favoritism. Partiality to the poor or favoritism to the great, but judge your neighbor fairly. Do not seek revenge or bear a grudge against anyone among your people, but love your neighbor as yourself." Or in Joel chapter 2, "Return to the Lord your God, for he is gracious and compassionate, slow to anger and abounding in love, and he relents from sending calamity." So before we go any further, I think one of the things we need to do is to get a more balanced picture of the Old Testament. If you just read the New Atheists, you will get the impression that it's murder and violence and war and blood on every page. And this is just a misleading impression. What they do is they focus on certain passages and they take them out of context and they emphasize that as being all the Old Testament has to say. Whereas when we look across the Old Testament, we get these sort of themes that in fact Jesus himself draws upon in the New Testament. We find a continual emphasis on the value and importance of the orphan, the widow, the poor, and the foreigner. We see God being loving and patient, even with people who reject him. And so the new atheists have given us a very distorted picture. And again, this doesn't make the problems go away, but I think we just need to put the record straight and say, look, there's more going on in the Old Testament than you're willing to let us know about. Well, let's then turn to the first of the three areas, and I really am going to have to be incredibly brief on the first two of these. One of the claims of the new atheists is that you just have all of these immoral characters doing all of these terrible deeds, and they're right, to a large extent you do. The Old Testament, and the New Testament as well, does not portray a book of moral saints who always do the right thing and unfailingly obey God's will. Far from it. The Bible portrays people, warts and all. It shows them in their good days, it shows them in their bad days. And we can think of somebody like Abraham, this great man of faith, and yet he lies about his wife to save his own skin. Or we think of David, a murderer. Or we think of somebody like Jephthah, a man who sacrificed his own daughter. Now, what is the Old Testament saying about that? Is it approving of that? Well, no, the Old Testament is prohibiting these things, but it's just telling us about these characters. These were deeply flawed men and women. Yet God graciously still, in many cases, chose to work through them. And so we're expected, as readers of the text, to realize the sin that is going on. It's not to think that when we read about child sacrifice, that therefore it's being approved. Of course it's not. So the first point I want to make here is just because something is described in the Bible does not mean that it's approved by God. And that's a very important point to make, and it's unfortunately often overlooked. Secondly, I'd want to draw attention to the fact that the Old Testament laws are provisional and are not God's final word. What God does, in fact, is he takes an ancient people with all their failings, with all their sin, and from that, he chooses a people to work out his purposes in history. One of the things that is clear from the Old Testament is that the law that is given, the covenant that God establishes with this group of people, is temporary. God has something better in store. The Old Testament covenant is there for a purpose, for a limited time, but God is bringing, if you like, the final picture later on. And of course, that's what we find in the New Testament. Now, this is not to undermine the Old Testament in any way. It's not to say that the Old Covenant was somehow wrong and bad. Paul highlights precisely this point. But it was provisional. Jesus also gives us an important pointer when he talks about divorce. In the context of divorce, Jesus says in the New Testament that Moses permitted divorce, you to divorce your wives because your hearts were hard. But it was not this way from the beginning. And so what Jesus is doing is pointing back to creation, to God's ideal in creation, and saying, but that's, you know, God has permitted other things that were not his ideal. He's tolerated things in his forbearance, as Paul will tell us in the New Testament. And so when we read about divorce, or when we read about something like polygamy in the Old Testament, again, this is not God's approval. We know that from the Old Testament itself. This was not God's ideal. But it is tolerated for a period. We can think of other commands. Think of the law relating to an eye for an eye and a tooth for a tooth. Well, again, one of the points here I'd want to make is that this was never intended literally. You just need to read the texts themselves to realize that. The idea wasn't that if you lost an eye, you were to take the eye from the other person. And again, this is reflected in Jesus' teaching. The idea, rather, was that the punishment should fit the crime. And in this respect, the Old Testament is actually quite advanced. It makes significant improvement in certain respects over other ancient law codes from the Near East. Take, for example, something like theft. In the law code of Hammurabi, which comes from Babylon, in the case of theft, the punishment was the death penalty. In the case of the Old Testament, theft, the punishment was that you had to compensate. It was double compensation for the theft. And so the idea was, an eye for an eye, the punishment had to fit the crime. And we see this in the very passages where this is mentioned in the Old Testament. It's applied in these kind of contexts about compensation, not about mutilation. We do find much more in terms of something like mutilation. We find that in other codes like Hammurabi. We'll come on to that a little bit later. But again, I think this is an important point, that the Old Testament places a great value of people over property. Let me take another example from Hammurabi. Let's suppose that somebody was building a house and the wall of the house fell down and killed a child. Well, according to the Hammurabi code, then a child of the builder was to be executed. Their life was to be taken. Their life for the life of the child. Now, that sounds like a literal life for life, but in the case of the Old Testament, there's nothing like that. Okay? So we see this difference between Hammurabi and the Old Testament. Now, before I overstate the case on this, let's just be careful, because the death penalty is there for all sorts of things in the Old Testament. Well, not all sorts of things. It's not there for theft, for example. There are 16 crimes for which the death penalty was available in the Old Testament. And here I think it's important that we set a little bit of context again. The Old Testament law is given in a particular context. It's not to be applied for all people at all time. It's in the context of a theocracy. It's God's covenant with a particular group of people to bring about his purposes. And for that group of people, they have signed up, if you like. They've signed up to this covenant. They've agreed to this covenant with God that they will keep it. And so people can leave Israel if they want to, but if they're going to be part of Israel, they must stick to this covenant. And so the laws are geared towards that situation. And so when we find, for example, laws like breaking the Sabbath or sacrificing to other gods, of course, we will look at those very differently in our context, and God does not expect that the death penalty should occur in our context for those kinds of things. But in the case of Israel, the point here was that these were part of their identity, part of the covenant. And so people who were rejecting these things were in effect rejecting God's covenant. And indeed, the implication seems to be that they were encouraging other peoples to do so. And so this had to be taken very seriously. However, what we also find is that it seems that in the Old Testament, the death penalty, although there, was not always required. The judges had flexibility in terms of how they implemented it, in terms of what the punishment was in a particular case. And it seems to be the payments of a ransom were available in many cases. In fact, Numbers 35 tells us that the payment of a ransom is unacceptable in the case of murder. Premeditated murder seems to be the only case in which a ransom is unacceptable. And so it may well be that many of these other cases, although the death penalty was there on the statute books, it was not carried out typically. So those are some of the considerations that we would need to look into in terms of thinking about laws. But again, I don't have time to go into those in more detail, and so I'm going to move on to our next topic of slavery. And here I'm going to be very, very brief indeed. The word slave, first of all, is important because it depends on the translators. It turns out that really, in the case of the laws of Israel, the word slave is inappropriate in almost all cases. It should really be servant. There was a type of servanthood, what's sometimes called indentured servitude, in the Old Testament. And the idea here was that this, and this is just from the text of the Old Testament, that this was actually designed to help the poor. It was to help the needy. In fact, it's clear that the idea, God's ideal, was that poverty would be eradicated. But in fact, of course, in the real world, this is especially in a sinful world, this was not going to be achieved. And so a system was in place. Now, they didn't have a system like our modern welfare system. So what was to happen? It was an agricultural society, and so people could lose their livelihood very quickly and incur great debt. And so what they could do is voluntarily become a servant to pay off their debts. Furthermore, servants in Israel were released after 6 years. They weren't allowed to hold on to their servants, slaves, their servants for indefinitely. They were to be released after 6 years, and debts were to be forgiven. Furthermore, they were to be treated as persons with rights, not as property. So there's just no comparison between the servanthood of the Old Testament and the slavery of the American colonies. We're not talking about the same thing at all, and this is often just glossed over. It's just assumed they were the same kind of thing. Let's take a servant. Again, if a servant is put to death by the master is held accountable by the law, by God. The master is to be put to death. And if a servant is injured, for example, if a tooth is knocked out, they get their freedom. That seems quite generous, actually. And again, when you look at the Old Testament laws on slavery compared to other laws in the ancient Near East, you see a marked difference in terms of the way that slaves or servants were treated. In Hammurabi, for example, which I mentioned earlier, the master was permitted to cut off the ear of a slave for disobedience. This was not permitted in Israel. Kidnapping for slavery, punishable by death. And perhaps the most significant factor here is runaway slaves. In Deuteronomy 23, we read that if a slave has taken refuge with you, do not hand them over to their master. Let them live among you wherever they like and in whatever town they choose. Do not oppress them. Again, very radical for its time. And again, I think it's important that we evaluate these laws in the context that they were given. We're not evaluating them against modern standards with a modern welfare system and so forth. We're looking at an ancient nation that God has taken in a particular context. And although there are divine, there are timeless truths, yet God is working in a particular context with this group of people. Contrast this with the Confederate states in America. Again, when we look there, they had this fugitive slave law, and so you were to return a slave. But in Israel, that was against the law. You were not to return a slave who had run away. And so we see really that on this whole issue of slavery, sometimes it's claimed that it was because people believed in the Bible that they instituted slavery in the states. Unfortunately, that might actually be true. It's because the people did use the Bible to support slavery, but actually they misused the Bible to support it. If they'd read the Bible carefully, they would not have supported slavery in the American South, for example. We're just not talking about the same kind of thing at all. So on the topic of slavery, I really think there isn't a problem. Okay, finally we come to the conquest of Canaan. And let's turn very briefly to Deuteronomy 7. When the Lord your God brings you into the land you're entering to possess and drives out before you many nations, the Hittites, Girgashites, Amorites, Canaanites, Perizzites, Hivites, and Jebusites, seven nations larger and stronger than you, and when the Lord your God has delivered them over to you, and you've defeated them, then you must destroy them totally. Make no treaty with them and show them no mercy. Do not intermarry with them. This is what you're to do to them. Break down their altars, smash their sacred stones, cut down their Asherah poles, and burn their idols in the fire. For you're a people holy to the Lord your God. The idea here is that God commands genocide. This is the claim of the new atheists. And then what happens is we have the Israelites under Joshua going in and carrying out genocide. What are we to say about this? Well, there's a few things I think, again, we need to get in context. So let me mention them to start with. First of all, God was judging the Canaanites. This was not based on one tribe eradicating another because they happen to have a different ethnicity. Whatever's going on here, it's going on because of God's judgment. Indeed, when we look at why God is judging them, it's because of practices such as child sacrifice. Furthermore, God's judgment was not hasty. In fact, according to Genesis, God has waited over 400 years. Remember what we read earlier? God is, what was it, slow to anger? Okay. God takes his time when it comes to punishment. And indeed, we see the same thing later with Israel. God gives people every opportunity to turn from their evil ways. Furthermore, when we come to the text of Joshua itself, we know the story about Rahab. Rahab, who's in Jericho, and the spies go into the land, and she acknowledges the God of Israel. She turns away from her own religion, from their own practices, and she acknowledges the true God. And what some people have said too in looking at this is that actually here we find this is very prominent in the early chapters of Joshua. Why? Why so prominent? Well, it looks like this is indicating that God is not commanding this because of the ethnicity of the people or anything like that. It's because of judgment, but God is willing to spare anyone who will turn, who will change their ways. Furthermore, it's a unique and limited event. And again, I think this is important. Some people say, well, look, we should live by this. If you believe this, we should be putting this into practice today. Why not? Why not go out and slaughter other nations? Well, that would be denying Christianity. When we look at Jesus' teaching in the New Testament, he says that his kingdom is not of this world. He tells us to love our enemies. He says, if you live by the sword, you'll die by the sword. So actually, we're not rejecting the Bible. We're obeying the Bible by not going down this route. We're not required to do what the ancient Israelites did. And so I think we need to see this in the context, actually, even of Israel. The conquest is very limited. It's a limited period of time, and although there are other wars and battles, in most cases these are not given divine sanction in the same way as the conquest of Canaan is. Still, that doesn't remove all the problems, does it? Okay, whatever God's commanded, is this what happens? Does God command genocide? And is genocide what takes place? Well, to answer this question, and there has been a lot written on this in recent years, and I'm only going to give you a very quick overview of some of this material. But the important thing here is that we need to read the Bible itself to see what it actually says. Let's turn to Joshua chapter 10. This is after there's been discussion about some of these battles and some of the things that have taken place. It says that so Joshua subdued the whole region, including the hill country, the Negev, the western foothills, and the mountain slopes, together with all their kings. He left no survivors. He totally destroyed all who breathed, just as the Lord, the God of Israel, had commanded. We then turn to Judges chapter 1, and the very first verse of Judges says, after the death of Joshua, the Israelites asked the God, who of us is to go up first to fight against the Canaanites? Which Canaanites was that then? The Canaanites that had been completely destroyed? Is there a conflict, a contradiction here between Joshua and Judges? In fact, actually we find a potential problem in Joshua itself. In loads of places, it's clear that after we've been told that Joshua has obeyed God, has carried out what God commanded, we find that there are loads of Canaanites still in the land. Just read the book of Joshua if you don't believe me. Just to give you one verse, in Joshua 15, Judah could not dislodge the Jebusites who were living in Jerusalem. To this day, the Jebusites live there with the people of Judah. So what's going on? Is there a conflict within the text? There's certainly a tension there. So, okay, I've given you an extra problem. You just thought it was how we deal with these difficulties. Now we've got a contradiction in the Bible. Well, let me turn to a couple of suggestions that have been made about this. When we look at that language, totally destroy, what exactly does it mean? And literally it means to devote. And that can be applied in different ways. But it does seem that in many of the passages, what we're talking about is a focus on destroying Canaanite religion. They're not to intermarry. They're not to engage in the practices of the Canaanites. Indeed, it's these evil practices which are stemming from the religious beliefs. And that, of course, leads to a problem later on. In fact, the Israelites end up engaging in some of these practices themselves. So that's the first thing. Furthermore, Joshua uses the rhetoric of ancient warfare. When we look at phrases like utterly perished, totally annihilated, left no survivors, What it seems is found in other ancient literature is that this kind of language is often used to describe great victories in battle. So, for example, the king of Moab in the 9th century BC says that Israel has utterly perished, even though, in fact, Israel wasn't even taken captive for over a century. Now, what's going on here? Let me be careful. What the people who are defending this sort of idea are not saying, they're not saying that the Bible is telling us something that is untrue. They're saying you need to understand the language, the kind of language that is being used. We always need to do that. Let's take another example. Matthew 5. Jesus says that if your eye causes you to sin, gouge it out. Now, Jesus is taking the sin absolutely seriously, but he doesn't intend to be taken literally. And similarly, the claim here is that in the Old Testament, in some of these passages, the sin is to be taken completely seriously. The annihilation of Canaanite religion is to be taken absolutely seriously, but it does not require killing every man, woman, and child. This at least is the claim of some authors, and I would encourage you to go and look at that. I can give you references later if you're interested, and to look at what the text actually says. Let me finish on one point. My time is really gone here. But let's look at the scale of the conquest. According to the book of Joshua itself, what happens is that the Israelites come into the land and base themselves at Gilgal. Then they go attacking places like Jericho and Ai, which it seems were very small towns. These were not massive big urban environments, but small towns. Or indeed, there's some indications that they were actually military forts. They were targeting military strongholds, not just the population at large. Furthermore, they carried out raids on the other southern towns and went back to Gilgal. They did not occupy the land until much later. We find the same story in the north. So according to Joshua itself, there is no sweeping slaughter of the Canaanites across the whole land and an immediate occupation. And yet, the book of Joshua tells us that Joshua had obeyed God's command. Writing about this, the Christian author and Egyptologist Kenneth Kitchen, in a wonderful book that you should, if you're interested in this, you should follow up on the reliability of the Old Testament, points to this problem, that some people who want to point out a problem in the Bible, a contradiction, he says that there is no contradiction here. He says it's a careless reading of such verses as these, without a careful and close reading of the narratives proper, that has encouraged Old Testament scholars to read into the entire book a whole myth of their own making, to the effect that the book of Joshua presents a sweeping, total conquest and occupation of Canaan by Joshua, which then can be falsely pitted against the narrative in Judges. The point here, and I'll not go through all of these points in detail, the point here is that there is no genocide. We're not talking about genocide or something of that kind in the book of Joshua. It simply is not taking place, even though they have obeyed God. I'll come back to that later, though, to what extent they obeyed God. But when we look at all of this, what we find is that the critics have failed to do justice to the Old Testament. In the case of the laws, we need to look at them in their context and see what's actually going on. Slavery is just not like the chattel slavery of more modern times. And finally, we need to think about all of this in the context of the New Testament. There are many issues here that I would encourage you to look into. And I'm not at all suggesting that this removes all the problems. There are difficult questions, and I don't know how to explain some of those texts. But as I said earlier, just because I don't understand it or don't have a resolution doesn't mean there is no resolution. But I think some of these factors do give us indications. Indications about how we might how these problems might be resolved, that there might be a true resolution, that God might have a good reason for all the things that he has done. Furthermore, my final question is, can we trust God? Even if we can't understand all that God has done, can we trust that God has been doing what is good and right? And to answer that question, I think the answer is certainly yes. We look at the New Testament and we look at a God who actually comes and lives among us. We look at the New Covenant. We look at a God who becomes a human being and dies in our place. Why? To deal with sin. So that we, like Rahab, might be forgiven. Let me say in conclusion that God's judgment is a terrible thing. Nothing I'm saying tonight should suggest that really God's judgment, not a big deal. God's judgment is a big deal. And we can't try to make that acceptable or to say that it's somehow pleasant and okay. God's judgment is a serious matter. Do we take it seriously? As Christians, do we gloss over it? Or if you're not a Christian, where do you stand in relation to God? Rahab turned to God. And what we've seen is that God is gracious and compassionate, slow to anger and abounding in love, and he gives us every chance to turn to him. 400 odd years for the Canaanites to turn. Indeed, the Israelites then turn away from God. What happens to them? God's merciful over a long period of time gives them every opportunity to change their ways. But eventually they too face judgment. And for us, I would say, we also will face God's judgment. And the question is, are we willing to respond to what God has actually done? God is desperate, is yearning, longs for us to turn away from our sin. And he has provided the means for us to do so through the death of his son. And so I would very strongly encourage you to think about that this evening as to what your response is. If you would like to speak to me or anybody else about any of these things afterwards, please do feel free to do so.